Russia is doing its best to withdraw troops from Georgia under an agreement brokered by France, but Russia is also establishing checkpoints along the border of Georgia and the breakaway region of South Ossetia, which Russia has taken over. And Russia is setting up military checkpoints in undisputed Georgian territory, including near the city of Gori on the main east-west highway. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown is in Afghanistan today. He's been meeting with Afghan President Hamid Karzai. He also visited British troops in Afghan's Helmand province in the south, offering them encouragement as Taliban attacks continue to increase. Britain has more than 8,000 troops in Afghanistan. I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
Do you have a question about digital radio or digital TV? Come to the WILL Digital Information Fair and Open House this Sunday from 2 to 4:30 at 300 North Goodwin, Urbana. Get your questions answered, tour Campbell Hall, meet our on-air hosts, and enter to win a digital TV or digital radio. We hope to see you this Sunday at Campbell Hall.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge Magazine, telling Champaign-Urbana's story to new residents and old. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and maps, as well as a business and shopping guide. Community Concierge Magazine is distributed four times a year throughout East Central Illinois.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about the very significant increase that we have seen over about the last 10 years or so in the amounts of money spent in judicial races across the country. And here, let me give you a couple of numbers just to demonstrate this. Between 1993 and 1998, candidates for America's highest courts raised $62 million. Between 1999 and 2007, that number jumped to over $165 million. And of those states across the country that use contestable elections to choose members of their high courts, three of the six most expensive are in the Midwest, and Illinois is one of them. In fact, Illinois has the dubious distinction of being the home to the most expensive contested judicial election in American history. That was in 2004, when two candidates combined to raise over $9.3 million. We'll talk some more about this trend, what it means for the functioning of the judiciary, and what it means for the way people think about the judiciary. And our guest for the program is Bert Brandenburg. He is executive director of a judicial watch organization that's called Justice at Stake. It is a nationwide, nonpartisan. It's a partnership that's made up of more than 45 judicial, legal, and citizen organizations across the country. If you're interested in finding more about the organization and the various issues that it's concerned with, they do indeed have a website that you can go to. That's a www.justiceatstake.org, and that's all as justice at stake, all as one word. So you can, I'm sure, find that easily. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Bert Brandenburg. He was the Justice Department's Director of Public Affairs and Chief Spokesperson under Attorney General Janet Reno. He also served in policy and communications positions for the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, for the National Performance Review, and the 1992 Clinton-Gore Campaign and Presidential Transition Team. He is an attorney, graduate of University of Virginia, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. All we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can get in as many callers as possible and keep moving, but anyone is welcome to call. If you are in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana if you're listening over the air or across the country on the internet. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, comments, you give us a call. Mr. Brandenburg, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're looking at some very significant numbers here. It seemed to me that $62 million is a pretty good amount of money, but $165 million is even more dramatic. And when you look at the increase, when you compare those two periods, this is quite significant, particularly when we're talking about judicial races. And I expect that for a long time, judicial races, really the spending was really quite low.
That's right. The numbers are big, and they're growing, and they are especially significant, as you say, when you think about what we're talking about. When you think about the original function of a court of law, to essentially decide a dispute fairly and to bend over backwards with many evidentiary rules and a lot of other things that make the law complicated to give both sides a fair shake, when we have a system whereby now increasing millions of dollars of money are being poured in by sides who invest that money very much to get judges who will rule their way, then we do have an increasing concern that something fundamental about the justice system is at liberty, and that's who judges will be accountable to. Will they be independent enough to call them as they see them, or will they feel like they are looking over their shoulder at contributors or potential opponents who might spend money against them in the next election, depending on how that next ruling goes?
Yeah. Just, I'm not sure how many people will clearly remember this 2004 race here in Illinois. It was for the Illinois seat on the Illinois State Supreme Court that set this new record for the amount of money that was spent. Just remind us about what happened there.
Well, and it's interesting because Illinois is one of just a handful of states in the country that actually divides its Supreme Court up by geographic districts. So there are various, like a congressional district, lines drawn across the state. And the district that was in play was a district that I think may go through a lot of your listening area. It goes through Carbondale and a lot of central Illinois, and so a reasonably rural district, certainly does not include a lot of the bigger media markets in Illinois. And yet, the two competitors, Judges Carmeier and Justice Mag, together spent, as you said, $9.3 million. One of them raised $4.8 million, the other $4.5 million, and they were quite busy raising this money from interest groups and attorneys who very much had business before the court, both before and after the election. And so when the smoke cleared in this rural area, you had $9.3 million raised, a national record set, and you actually had the winner on election night, Justice Carmeier, saying, "Isn't this obscene? How can the public have confidence in the system?" Not your usual election night speech by a victorious candidate. And I think he was so shaken even on election night by what had happened and what the system is now requiring judges do if they want to be competitive in this races, that he couldn't even help himself on election night to voice this very public concern.
And even though here in Illinois, as I said and we've discussed, we have the distinction of having the most expensive race, other states around us, significant amounts of money have been spent, a lot of money spent in Wisconsin, not all that far behind, in Ohio, and apparently in Michigan, record keeping is so poor that no one knows exactly how much, but there are some people apparently who think that there has been even more money spent than the one that we have here in Illinois, where we can claim the record.
Well, disclosure laws are part of the problem, and Illinois, actually to its credit, has improved its disclosure regime in the last few years. But this also gets into another really big issue for these races, which is there's the money that goes into the candidates, and that actually is reasonably well reported in the various states. What we don't know as much about, even though we know it's big, is the enormous amount of money going into independent expenditures. So groups that won't necessarily give money to a candidate, but clearly run ads that are designed to help push you towards a particular candidate or against the one they don't like. And depending on the state, the laws are often quite weak in terms of understanding who's actually putting that money together, whose interest is behind that ad. In some cases, it might be pretty obvious, depending on the issue they bring up. In other cases, it's not. We've seen, for example, business groups that will run crime ads. And so you see the ad and you figure it's somebody upset about how the rape law works, and then you find out eventually that it was perhaps groups that were interested more in tort issues. And that lack of disclosure is one of the biggest problems here, because you have this sense not only of the money pouring in, but if the public can't even know where it's coming from, then it's harder for them to make up their mind, number one, about who they want to vote for, but number two, whether they should have confidence in the system.
Hmm. We have seen significant amounts of money spent in various states across the country. But what seems to be interesting and is indeed the focus of this particular report that we're talking about and that people can read if they want to go to your website, is that a number of these high-spending states, in fact, three of the six most expensive in the country, are in the Great Lakes and region, and here in the Midwest, which makes one wonder, well, why should that be? What is it about the Midwest particularly that should contribute to this trend?
It is an interesting question. I don't have an easy answer. I have some suggestions as to what might have contributed to it. Number one, not every state has competitive elections for its Supreme Court seats. In many states, they have what are called retention elections, where a judge who was appointed stands for election, or rather re-election, in a race where they don't have an opponent. Those races do not tend to attract as much money. As it happens, each of the Midwestern states has contested elections, at least for the initial seating of justices, and those races do tend to attract a lot more money. Secondly, we do see nationally that this is an outgrowth of the tort wars. So you have a lot of money coming in from trial attorneys, a lot of money coming in from business groups, labor unions, et cetera. And I think it's just fair to say that in the Great Lakes states, for reasons of kind of political culture, those factions are pretty well organized in these states to actually put this money together, run the campaigns. I think as well that for years at least, the courts in these states, when you look at background by, say, party membership, have been reasonably even or close enough so that somebody would consider it an investment. They've actually tipped the court the other way if they can win a race or two. I think when you add those three factors up, that's probably a fair amount of why the Great Lakes region, as we kind of dubbed it for this purpose of this report, seems to be the national epicenter for this trend. But it is striking that one of the states you mentioned, Wisconsin, actually had not had any of these problems until about 2 years ago. They had managed to have a political culture that this was not such a growth industry, there was not such a spillover of the big money, and then that did change a couple of years ago, and it just sort of demonstrates how easily it can change. And in Minnesota, which we also looked at, it's not been as bad yet, but that's one of the reasons they're actually working on reforms now. They're hopeful of getting ahead of the curve and trying to do something about the big money before it arrives at their doorstep.
Yeah, we should give a nod to Minnesota because it seems that to date they have not participated in this trend the way that other states, Illinois, particularly Illinois, Ohio, Wisconsin, have.
That's right. And again, political culture is an interesting thing. It just hasn't really happened so much yet, but I think it's fair to say that people in Minnesota are concerned that it could. They see it happening everywhere else. This really, around the year 2000, which was the first really huge growth year, and before that it had been far sort of sleepier, the growth began to take off in a hurry in 2000, and that was really Ohio in particular, to some extent Illinois, but also Alabama and at one point Texas and Mississippi were leaders in this area as well. What's interesting in those states is that once one party got such a dominant point on the court through elections, then the election spending began to die down a bit because it was just not seen as competitive. The political money would just go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, we're finding that nationally in more and more states, judicial elections have kind of like the fishing hole that's been discovered. Once somebody found it, everybody else is coming in, and it's becoming a why not spend money if I can perhaps, you know, get investment. There's a joke somebody made, I think, from a labor union years ago. It's just a lot cheaper to buy a court than it is to buy a state legislature.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Bert Brandenburg. He is the executive director of a judicial watch organization that is called Justice at Stake. They're based in Washington, D.C., and this is essentially an umbrella organization. They have partners in more than 45 judicial, legal, and citizen organizations around the country, including here in the state of Illinois. And we're talking about the increase in spending in judicial races, concentrating particularly here on the Midwest, and that is a subject of a report that Justice at Stake has put together, and you can look at that and other things if you're interested in finding more about them. You can go to their website, www.justiceatstake.org. And, of course, questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that after this 2004 race, Judge Carmeier, who was the winner, actually said in his comments after that night, commented on the enormous amounts of money that were raised and spent and saying that he was clearly uncomfortable with that. I think that the extent to which people know about the justice system, understand how it's structured, when they vote, the degree to which they're informed, there are really questions about how much people know and when they vote, how they decide who they're voting for. We know that there are people like Judge Carmeier who are concerned about this, but is this something, do you think, that actually concerns voters?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. When they have an opportunity to pay attention to it, there's a pretty high level of concern. As a general matter, if you ask people if they believe that campaign contributions affect the outcome of decisions in the courtroom, about three in four Americans believes that right now, which is pretty sad, and there's a lot of cynicism if you ask people about just the practice of judges having to dial for dollars and raise money from the people who appear before them in court. On the other hand, it's not a breakfast table issue most of the time. This is not an issue people wake up saying, what can I do about my courts today? One of the rare exceptions is when there might be a race like this that people pay attention to briefly, perhaps in their area, or more nationally, an issue not having to do with the election of judges, but with the courts generally and political attempts to interfere with them. You think about the Terry Schiavo case a few years ago. That actually was something of an education moment in an interesting way, in the sense that once the public, after a couple months of immersion from watching on cable television how the case was playing out, once they saw how the justice system was working and what was going on in Washington in terms of attempts to tamper with the courts, there was actually a great public outcry against what Congress had done. And there was a lot of backpedaling in D.C., but these are the exceptions. And it gets to a very real issue for judicial elections themselves, which is that because there is not traditionally a lot of focus on them, voter turnout in judicial elections is often at the very lowest of all the offices that are up for election. And there are documented cases of good voters, people who make an effort every time to vote for president, but also for governor, and they're the ones who are there for the city council races. The people who really take this seriously, they get to the judicial names on the ballot, and they stop. And we've actually done focus groups and asked them, why? Why do you stop? And they say, we don't have enough information about the courts and what it means, and we also don't have enough information about the candidates. We actually think we're being good voters by stopping, because it would be wrong to make an uninformed choice. What that means is it's a voter vacuum, and it's an invitation for interest groups to try to jump into these races, because if I'm an interest group and trying to tip one of these races, I'll get a lot more for my dollar if I go into a race where voter turnout is already very low and I just have to turn out my base, versus a race where people are going to vote anyway and I'm trying to actually change their mind. Much harder thing to do. So the issue of voter education is both sort of a general problem for the courts, but it also looms huge in this area. And one of the big reforms that we're very much behind is the idea that anything that can be done to get more nonpartisan voter guides in people's hands, be it through the internet or something in their newspaper or a website that they hear about in a radio ad or something like that, and they can go to just with information from the candidates, hopefully that would raise that supply of voters and make it less easy to tip these races one way or the other.
The money that we're talking about, these large amounts of money, like other candidates, I'm sure these candidates are using that money to buy television ads, and then there are also groups that are running ads on behalf of one or the other candidates, and they can often be extremely negative. Does it concern you? Is there reason to believe that if these campaigns do have a very negative tone, and that's what people are exposed to, that it will affect the way that citizens and voters think about the judiciary?
I think that is of concern. I don't want to overstate it. I think we're, because of what's happening in society, we're all increasingly, having to be more media savvy. And my understanding is that political scientists are documenting the fact that commercials themselves are just reaching some type of intellectual saturation point where perhaps they're not as influential as they used to be. I don't quite know, but I could certainly see that happening. So I'm not trying to overstate the case that when we see bad ads about the courts, that they'll necessarily tear people's sense of what the courts are for all the way down. But I think there is potentially a cumulative toll. If you did nothing but look at the television advertisements that that are run in these campaigns, you would see this dark fantasy world, and it's populated by abused children and fearsome rapists and malevolent corporations and greedy lawyers and judges who apparently spent all their time trying to hurt ordinary Americans. And you hear frightening horror movie music, and then you're asked to vote for a judge. I don't think that has to be decisive, but it can't not have an influence in the long run, particularly if you feel like an institution that has been able to avoid a lot of what's been going on in American politics is now at risk of getting dragged down into American politics. The public's confidence in the courts usually rates higher than the other political branches. Whether that'll be as true in the long run, I'm not so sure.
Just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. Bert Brandenburg is the executive director of Justice at Stake. This is a Judicial Watch organization. It's based in Washington, D.C. It is a nonpartisan group. It's a partnership that includes more than 45 judicial, legal, and citizen organizations across the country. And one of the things they're concerned with and have tracked is the amount of money that is spent in judicial races here in the United States. They have put out a report on this, specifically looking at the Midwest, and the reason they're concentrating on the Midwest is that some of the most expensive states are here in the Midwest. And in fact, of those states that use contestable elections to choose members of their high courts, and there are 22, 3 of the 6 most expensive are here in the Midwest. They are Illinois, Ohio, and Michigan. And in fact, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, the most expensive contested judicial election in American history took place here in the state of Illinois. It was for the Illinois Supreme Court. That was in 2004 when the two candidates together raised over $9.3 million. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Who is it that's giving the money? Where is it coming from?
Well, as I was mentioning earlier, I think the vast majority of the money is coming through, in terms of interest groups, the tort wars. So on the business side, that's usually money organized either, depending on the state law, directly from companies or from companies into organizations. Like in the case of Justice Carmeier, you had money that went into groups like the Illinois State Medical Society or political action committees. And you saw the Chamber of Commerce giving money to a group called JustPAC in Illinois. You saw a group called the American Tort Reform Association. So you see national money coming in from out of Illinois as well as in-state Illinois manufacturers, American Insurance Association, et cetera. On the other side, and I should add as well, with Justice Carmeier, you also had the Illinois Republican Party giving a fair amount of money. What was interesting, the dynamics are a little bit different on the other side in this sort of tort war arms race, in the sense that with Justice Mag in that race in 2004, a lot more of that money came from individuals, usually trial attorneys who have the ability to write big checks. And rather than writing them individually to the Justice Mag, a lot of them tended to write the checks either to their own PAC, which was called Justice for All PAC, or to the Democratic Party of Illinois. So on paper, the Democratic Party of Illinois considerably outspent the Republican Party, but that actually doesn't account for the fact that a lot of Republican money was instead going through a PAC. So it gets a little bit complicated, but the boiled down answer on the money side is it really is the tort wars, and it's trial lawyers, labor unions versus businesses. We've seen evidence of other types of organizations who care about judicial races getting more involved, but usually less in terms of money. So, for example, you see groups that care very much about social issues, say abortion or the death penalty, coming up with questionnaires, and their way of trying to influence the debate is to write a questionnaire to a judicial candidate saying, where are you going to stand on these issues that may come before you? Tell us in advance as much as you can, and we would like that to be a lot of information on how you might rule if one of, you know, quote unquote, our issues comes up. And then that information gets distributed out to memberships. And of course, these days, membership tools are pretty sophisticated. Once you have that information, you can use the web and email, various other mechanisms for getting the word out.
Well, when one asks this question, if you give money to a candidate, what it is you're hoping to achieve? Is it the case that there's a naked sort of a line to be drawn between the group and the judge, and the hope that in future, if you appear before that judge, they'll recognize the fact that you had supported them? Or is it in a sense more a little bit more diffuse in that what it is you think you're doing is that you're getting a justice who is in his judicial temperament and in his judicial, his or her judicial temperament or philosophy is going to be more in harmony with yours, so that what you're thinking is that chances are then they're going to rule in a way that's favorable to you, not because of you specifically, but because that's their orientation, and that's in a sense the way that you are, what you're getting for your money.
Right. I'm sure there's some of both. I will say that these are high-powered people on both sides. They make strategic decisions all the time. That's how they made money in the first place, either as attorneys or business people. And they very, very much believe that if they spend money, they want something back for their investment. So even if they don't necessarily have a case in court soon, it can't be far from their mind that they may have a case in court. And then sometimes law firms will literally bundle money from various attorneys just so you knew that the money is coming from the firm that comes in. But it's also, it gets to a broader and important question here in the sense that, you know, where judges are elected, you can't just condemn all attempts to support candidates you might like. And you, of course, don't have, you know, ESP to know about the motivation of every single donor. There does need to be room to be able to support a candidate you like just because you think they're the better candidate. I would say that very sort of impossible to perfectly draw a line between that general support because you like a judge generally and then wanting them to rule on certain cases in advance is the problem here, in the sense that once a judge, even if it's under the name of philosophy, knows in advance how they're going to rule in a case, then something has gone wrong. The Constitution guarantees due process to people. And if I walk into a courtroom and I feel like the judge has decided the case already, and in particular, the judge got a lot of money from somebody who was on the other side, in that event, I'm going to be pretty worried. And I think that's the source of a lot of public dissatisfaction with cash piling up in the courtroom, even though it does involve a very tricky question of line drawing, you know, into a classic role of elections when you're choosing a candidate you like.
Just real quick, one other question, and I promise I have two people I will get right to. What should happen if someone is scheduled to appear before a judge, and that in a case, and that individual has contributed significant amounts of money to that judge's election, then that judge should recuse himself, should say, well, there should not even be a potential appearance of conflict here. So to make sure that there isn't any, I'm just going to step aside here and I'm not going to be involved in this case. How often is it the case that that happens?
Very rarely. And in fact, this is one of the major reforms being now debated around the country. And in Illinois, for example, Justice Carmeier, when he was in the process of winning that race, got a lot of money from State Farm. He then was the deciding vote after he got on the bench on a case that involved State Farm. The other side asked him to recuse himself for the exact reason you describe. He declined to do so, and the case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which declined to hear it. So they didn't rule one way or the other, but it stood as it was. And this is really the norm around the country, that there has been an extreme hesitance on the part of judges to take themselves out of cases over campaign contributions. But what I do think is changing is as the amount of money going into these races has exploded, and we're no longer dealing with smaller checks that come in, they're going to come anyway, but these million-dollar races, then I think this is being relooked at. And in fact, as we speak, the U.S. Supreme Court is being asked once again to consider a case, this time out of West Virginia, where you had a Supreme Court justice there who was very much elected and unseated an incumbent with the help of millions of dollars from a particular energy executive. Then he himself was the deciding vote in an energy case, and which was that donor won the case. The other side, which was another corporation, this was a corporation versus corporation suit, has gone to the Supreme Court and asked the Supreme Court to take a fresh look at this. And interestingly enough, Ted Olson, the former Solicitor General for Attorney General Ashcroft, is actually taking the side of the corporation that's asking for recusal. So I actually think we may see more about recusal in the coming months, years, even though it's been not very well examined as a reform in the past, but it sort of, in the end, it comes back to this distinction between what you want a judge to do and what other people do in politics. Judges are supposed to be different, and we do want elected officials like legislators and executives to make promises and to keep them. I will cut your taxes. I want you to do that because I supported you. I will make your health care better. You know, you're supposed to do that because I supported you. A judge, instead, is supposed to decide cases one at a time. They are not supposed to, quote-unquote, perform based on campaign trail promises or money that's coming in. And that's what makes it so tricky when you have a situation where you're electing judges.
All right. We have callers here. We'll get to write to them. We'll talk with someone in Camargo, and this is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I was wondering if there's any means of publication of these large donors in the newspaper. There could be some kind of an allotment that whenever people put in money, that the top donors, top 25, would have to relinquish a certain amount of their money. So this is public record and published in a large advertisement in like the Chicago Tribune and other newspapers that would alert people that this is being done and who's doing it.
Interesting proposal. I think when it gets to the actual mechanism, almost like a contribution tax,
right,
to go for a publication, I can't imagine that'd be very easy to get through politically. With that said, in the sort of spirit of the comment, I would say in Illinois there are organizations like the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform that work very hard to take the data from the agencies, which are themselves, I think, improving largely around the country at reporting this out. And so there are more and more mechanisms. So even if it weren't an ad in the newspaper, hopefully more and more of this information will be surfacing. And certainly in the era of the Internet, it ought to be rather easy for people to get this information, subscribe to the information, and one would hope that reporters would cover this aspect of the story. Our experience over the last 7-8 years as we've worked with state media around the country is that there is increasing sensitivity to this. I actually would love it if top donors from both sides were more formally published. I don't know if we'll get there, but I think a lot of it is, you know, media does try to be responsive to its audiences, and if more people like yourself were going to the newspapers and saying, I want you to cover this.
I think that's a very valid point, but I mean, to put a full-page ad in Chicago Tribune, very few of these think tanks and nonprofit organizations that have good intentions are ever going to be able to afford to do that.
That is true.
And I think we need a mechanism to say, well, if you guys want to contribute this much, then you shouldn't be afraid to announce into the world that you are contributing this much. And then, because people will be aware of it, then there's more likelihood that a newspaper would further investigate these things.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the comment.
In addition, I'd like to point out there's got to be some way that even a judicial review of cases, that if there's something that comes up like this, why isn't there a panel of judges that can make a decision that says, you know, we think this case should be covered by so-and-so because we do know that that particular judge has had a lot of donations put in his campaign in a particular area. And so it would take the hand, I mean, it would be still a judicial review that would say, 10 judges says, you know, I think this judge should cover this case as opposed to this judge over here. Why couldn't something like that be done?
I mean, that's a perceptive point, and I think different states have different case management, allocation systems, so I don't pretend to speak for Illinois or anybody else. But I actually think that's a very positive suggestion, and, you know, hopefully to some extent that may be done now, but it gets to a related suggestion in the world of recusal. One of the reforms that's been put forward is the idea, at the very least, that if I'm the judge and you're in a case and you're worried about that donation and you ask me to recuse, that at the very least, what if we had a reform that said that very judge who received the question is not the person who decides? Because typically right now, at least in most states, it's the very person who's asked to recuse who then makes the decision. And one can sort of imagine all types of problems from just human nature as to how easy that is to do and also how much faith we can have in that decision if it at least went to a separate judge or perhaps a separate panel of judges who said, you know, maybe this one's okay. We'll go ahead and keep the judge on there. There would be more confidence that somebody else had looked at it.
Well, I mean, if you have a system of checks and balances like we have in our government, shouldn't there be some system of checks and balances in the judicial sector? I mean, why should a judge have that kind of authority, almost dictatorial? Well, I'm going to do it whether you like it or not.
Well, and I think, you know, we like to say in the end, it's the justice system is not about judges, it's about courts. And I think you're exactly right that this should not be seen about the kind of prerogatives of a particular judge, but it should be the court system creating the best possible environment for equal justice to then be administered by judges who in the end do have to do the day job and do all the work. But I think you're exactly right that the system should be set up so that there's few points as possible for risk that a decision by an individual will be just seen as some element of either being accountable to a contributor or just not really recognizing a perception problem if it comes before them.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is someone here in Champaign County where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I think one can go to the root of the problem and not say judicial elections are that much different than other elections. And what I'm suggesting is that the money in politics needs to be addressed more directly at all levels for other kinds of elections. And there has to be a way, and the irony here is that judges decide whether that's constitutional or not, I guess, in this case. So it seems to me that there has to be a way of financing elections, whether they be of judges or presidents, so that the bidding for corporate influence is not the dominant factor, which it is these days. The election for the Supreme Court that we had was amazing because, as you pointed out, the thing that was being contested by the moneyed interests was not what was the advertising was spent on. There are all these side dark issues and cases. Very little was actually said about tort reform and the cap on punitive damages that was really at stake.
I think that's right. They do tend to be shadow campaigns. And in terms of your first point, I think you're exactly on that systemic reform of how the money comes in is one of the major reforms out there. Our group talks about three general areas of reform that are probably the biggest. There's a couple dozen things you could do, but to pick out the big three, we've talked about recusal, and I think that's coming on as a reform, and I'm hoping we'll see more states soon trying to take that up. Another one that I'll just mention briefly for the moment is states that have these merit selection retention systems whereby a judge is initially picked through an appointment that benefits from a screening committee that helps come up with, you know, if not the best candidates, at least screen out people who would obviously be unqualified, but then those judges would stand for election periodically in these retention elections, every X years. When it comes to contested elections and trying to get out of the trap that the two judges found themselves in Illinois a few years ago, public financing of judicial elections is increasingly being looked at. North Carolina adopted it for Supreme Court and appellate races some years ago, and they've been pretty pleased with the success. And so you basically have a system whereby judges don't have to dial for dollars their contributors. They don't have to spend all their time raising money. Instead, by getting a certain amount of seed money, they have to sort of prove that they're viable through a certain number of initial contributions. They then qualify for the system. They're able to get money that comes in, you know, not from donors, and then run using that money. They then pledge that they won't raise other outside money. Usually that system has some type of emergency fund if your opponent doesn't buy into the system, because you can only make these systems voluntary, that you get some extra money if you're outspent. But the idea is, and as a judge in North Carolina said to me, now I actually spend my time talking to voters instead of just spending all my time courting donors.
Well, I think that's the one that should be the number one on the priority, really, is the, and we've seen it break down at the presidential level, the voluntary aspect.
And in fact, in Illinois, there has been a bill that's been passed by the state Senate several times, though I don't think this session, that would institute public financing for judicial elections. Wisconsin also, their state Senate passed a full public financing measure last year as well. So this is being looked at seriously. For any jurisdiction that wants to have competitive elections, I think it's increasingly important to consider public financing.
I'll sign off on this, but what happened in this in Wisconsin? Was it blocked in the House?
That is right. It did not get a hearing in the House, even though it was pretty popular in the Senate. There's some speculation that, depending on how the election comes out in the state races in Wisconsin this fall, that the equation may change. The governor seems supportive as well. So I guess I would say stay tuned.
All right. I want to jump in here real quick. We have about 10 minutes left, and I would like to again introduce the guest for this hour. We're talking with Bert Brandenburg. He is the executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based organization Justice at Stake. This is a nationwide nonpartisan partnership of more than 45 judicial, legal, and citizen organizations, and they're concerned with judicial reform. And one of the things that they're concerned with is the amount of money that is spent in judicial races. And we've been talking about the fact that, say, over the last 10 years or so, there has been a very, very significant increase in the amount of money spent. And some of the most high-spending states happen to be here in the Midwest, and Illinois is one of them. If you're interested in reading some more about these issues and finding out more about Justice at Stake, they do indeed have a website, which is justiceatstake.org. So you can go there. And questions here are welcome, continue to be welcome here as we continue for about another 10 minutes. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to go back and talk about merit selection retention. And I think that, you know, there are some people who perhaps their answer to this problem would indeed be something like some kind of merit selection, which, although maybe has some positives, some people would say, well, can you really keep politics out of that as well? It just works in a different sort of way.
Well, that's right. There are no perfect systems. There are no systems without politics, nor should there be. I mean, it's a democratic society, so we want appropriate democratic pressures to come in, and again, it's so challenging with the courts because we don't want them to be a purely political institution. We don't want them to be as responsive to the normal political pressures that we expect executives and legislators to be responsive to. So merit selection, the challenge, therefore, is do you want a system whereby the initial appointment of a judge is not done through an election, that it would be in the back end that the public has their say, and the people who point to its advantages feel that it produces a more sort of routinely high-quality set of judges, even though a lot of excellent judges are routinely elected as well. It's not as if there's any obvious superiority there. I do believe that I've heard statistics from a couple states that suggest that the number of judges who end up during their career fouled up in ethics problems themselves seems to be lower under merit selection systems. We do know that the amount of money that goes into these races usually far lower because the retention race, as it's called, that you stand for periodically is one where you're on the ballot, but you actually don't have an opponent. It's a referendum on you. And so the judge can be fired by the public, but they're not choosing between one candidate and the other. That tends to make the races less of a circus. There are probably now, 18 or 19 states that use this form of selection for their Supreme Courts. There's another 18 or 19 that use contested elections. There are some that use just straight appointments. Many states use different systems at different levels of their courts. So there's really no two states in the country who have the exact same system of picking and keeping their judges if you include the length of their terms. It is a true patchwork.
We have someone else to bring into the conversation in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up the point that when people talk about the public funding of elections, they never usually seem to bring up the point that what that means is now the elections are controlled by the institutionalized political class. And I wondered if you had a comment on that. What I think is the problem, these huge money donations, I don't think you're ever going to get the money out of anything. I would rather see a system where these new kinds of soft money donations are disposed of, and you just simply have transparency and everything is hard money. Donation. If you could comment on that, I'll listen. Thank you.
In terms of, number one, your question about public financing, in terms of the risk that, as you put it, would be controlled by the political class, I think the best designed system would hopefully avoid that in the sense that you would not want it to be a situation whereby party leaders, for example, or even you know, people who are political appointees in the government decide who gets it or not. You want very objective criteria so that the law decides who gets it. And in particular, you want it set up so that there is some amount of political proof that you have that you're a viable candidate, and therefore you go out and you get a certain number of signatures or a certain amount of small donations. And I think it's fair to ask anybody who wants to be considered for important office to do some of that grassroots homework up front to show you're viable. That is a bit of a threshold, but I think that would still get you people who have some potential for vigorous support. In terms of the issue of, you know, soft money and transparency and putting all the money and hard money into donations, presumably you meant to the candidates themselves. The problem is that there's no regulatory way to simply say, you know, you can't do that under interpretations of the Constitution and the First Amendment. You can't make outside money go away. However, you can absolutely do more to try to make it more transparent. And certainly, you know, it's a very good idea, and frankly, all kinds of elections, to try to make every dollar as public as possible so that people at least have the benefit of knowing where the money's coming from, even if it can't be controlled as tightly as contributions can. Mm.
We're down point here. We have 3-4 minutes left. I'm interested in going back to an earlier point. You were talking about the fact that sometimes people who are trying to be good citizens, people who do vote, and when they go into the voting booth, they try to make informed choices. Sometimes if you see what they do or if you ask them afterwards, you find out they're not voting in judicial races. And then when when you ask them, they say, well, you know, I don't feel comfortable in voting in this race because I really don't feel that I know who the candidates are and what they stand for. I don't feel I have enough information here, so I'm just not going to vote. So clearly here also, in all of this, there ought to be some sort of a way for voters to get, if they are indeed going to be voting on judges, to get more information about who they are, what they believe in, what they stand for, so that then they can feel more comfortable with casting a vote because they feel indeed they know something about the candidates.
I think that's exactly right, and you know, the same voters we talked to who were worried about this, they said if we had some basic information, some resume background, 100-word statement from the candidate, that would go a long way towards helping us choose between one of the other candidates. And I think for any voter who's worried about this, the thing to do is, you know, you hope the information comes to you from somebody else, but probably figure that it won't, and therefore do a little bit of looking around. But in the age of the Internet, it shouldn't be too terribly hard. There are organizations out there. I think I mentioned the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform. Mm-hmm. They quite frequently link to nonpartisan voter guards. A lot of bar associations will have ratings that are done by the people who actually work in the courthouses and the litigants and the people who see the judges up close, and they'll get a sense of who they think the better judges are, maybe the judges who are not so good. The Secretary of State's office should be a source. And, of course, there will be interest group voter guides as well. Those should be looked at as well. But I think the real gold standard is a voter guide that is nonpartisan, that really lets the candidates speak for themselves and doesn't try to kind of characterize them or force their hand through questions that are simply designed to, you know, work on one issue at the expense of kind of the judge's broader role of looking at every case equally.
Try to get one more caller here, someone in Seneca on our toll-free line, line 4 right here. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, the problem I see personally that people aren't educated enough on it, and you brought up the fact that there isn't a lot of information out there. Well, I beg to differ. I've gone online and did my research on it. The problem is I hear this complaint time and time again. Well, I don't have time. I've got to drag my kids to soccer and baseball or football practice, or I've got to work, or I've got to do this. The bottom line to me personally, from every person that I've ever talked to, you bring certain names up and they say, who are you talking about? Like, for instance, Bob Barr. They don't know who Bob Barr is. Or for instance, Ralph Nader. Well, I didn't know he was running. You know, the point is there's unfairness, too, on top of the media aspect of it. But the bottom line is the reason why we're in this mess in the first place in this country is because of two reasons. One is, you know, uneducated public going to vote and just going eeny, meeny, miny, moe and sitting in the fence. Well, I don't know. I'm going to stick with my own party. Nobody wants to change. And the other one is just the fact that, you know, nice guys finish last, basically. You can't, you know, an honest person at my age or my, you know, background can't do it. Same thing with you guys. Good luck in trying to run because you're not Mr. Popularity. You're not like the Hollywood likes to call it, the beautiful young blonde, you know, good-looking type girl. And in politics, it's old style, old head, and we need to start changing things, like maybe some change in the way we set up our voting booths and the way we, you know, just basically the whole thing needs to be changed. I don't want to go too far into it because I know people will, you know, some other person might bring it in. But the bottom line is our country has gone down the toilet, and unless we do something fast, it's just going to get worse.
All right. Well, let's get a comment here while we still have some time. I don't know how you might want to comment on that.
Well, it's probably a good point at which I know you're wrapping up here to think about in closing, in the sense that the issue I'll pull out here is the broader issue of civic education. And it's well documented that in addition to the challenges the country faces with education generally, that civic education in particular has had a hard road in the last several decades, and even a lot of the reforms coming out of No Child Left Behind focused on math and science and didn't really do much in terms of civic education. And I think that, number one, applying more pressure on public officials to improve civic education is taught in the schools. But then, number two, knowing that that's not going to solve everything, this is where bootstraps and energy go a long way. And, you know, working with nonprofit organizations that are out there trying to educate people one at a time, working through groups like Rotary Clubs and Chambers of Commerce that could invite judges in, for example, to speak and get information firsthand, working through your own sort of communities. And the Internet, I will say, I do believe that it has made the cost of seeking that information so low now that while it is true that there will be a lot of people who probably still won't get the information, a lot more can. And therefore, moving people towards Internet sources, I actually think in this area where judicial elections could just use 10% more voters, and I think it would be a very helpful benefit, you know, of all stripes, voting for all candidates. That, I think, is achievable in the world of the Internet if people can actually just know that those resources are there, because hopefully what the caller said won't be true if I can spend maybe 15 minutes before an election looking at a voter guide and saying, okay, I can pick one judge versus the other there. I won't know perfectly. And, you know, hopefully judicial elections, even though it's getting worse, have not yet been taken over by Hollywood, and we'll get the people who will be the best judges.
Just here, very quickly, is it possible to get people enough information about judges and how they think, and at the same time preserve what the judges want to consider is the appearance, at least, of judicial impartiality? Because it seems that often judges, particularly the higher you go, they don't want to answer direct questions about what they think. Can you actually satisfy both of those?
Not perfectly. You never will be able to. It's the exact right question, and there's no perfect way. You do want to reserve to the judge the ability to say, I haven't spoken out too much in advance. But you want to provide as much positive information as possible, knowing that it won't be fully satisfactory, but at least will help some voters over the hump to make a decision about, say, judicial philosophy generally. You might point them towards past decisions and the like as well, if they've been an incumbent judge.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. With our thanks to Bert Brandenburg. He is the Executive Director of Justice at Stake, based in Washington, D.C. And again, if you're interested in finding out more about this organization, you can go to their website, which is www.justiceatstake.org. Mr. Brandenburg, thank you very much.
Thanks to you and your callers. Excellent questions all around.
Very good. Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information available at 384-2444. Almost 60% of all school children in the United States get free school lunches. The program is the single most important source of nutrition for poor children. Next time on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at the history of school lunches in America. The host, Celeste Quinn, will be talking with historian Susan Levine. She's author of the book School Lunch Politics, The Surprising History of America's Favorite Welfare Program. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. The show itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580. In the next hour of this program, we'll be talking about efforts to protect the Great Lakes. And our guest for the show will be Dave Dempsey, author of the book Great Lakes for Sale. First, though, we'll take a break for an update on the markets and news, so please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. And we'll start our examination with the outside markets, which are impacting grain prices today. The October crude oil price is now at $121.20. It's up $5.64, while the U.S. dollar has fallen more than 60 cents on the day. That, as well as continued concerns about dry weather conditions and some minor support out of the John Deere Pro Farmer Crop Tour regarding yields in Illinois potentially being a little less than thought off of USDA numbers, as well as the three-year average of Pro Farmer, is keeping some support under the market as well as leading the market higher. Let's go ahead and then look at the particulars for you. In Kansas City, September wheat now at 940, up 34. December, 964, up 36 and 3 quarters. September wheat at the Board of Trade, 910, up 35 and a quarter. December, 937 and a half, up 38. March, 961, up 36 and 3 quarters. September corn, 598 and 3 quarters, up 23 and a half. December, 618, up 23. March, 637 and a half, up 23 and a half.